Hi, I'm Alan Saunders, this is the Philosopher's Zone, and this is The Philosopher. The Philosopher is the nickname of Symphony No. 22, written by Joseph Haydn in 1764. The name probably comes from what you're listening to now, the counterpoint between the strings and the cor anglais, which sounds like a debate of question and answer. Whatever, there's no doubt that this carefully balanced work is a product of the great period in European cultural life known as the Enlightenment. The era of Thomas Jefferson and Voltaire, David Hume and Immanuel Kant, and there's no doubt that Haydn was a man of the Enlightenment. Yet Haydn was a devout Roman Catholic, unlike many of his French philosophical contemporaries who were atheists. So clearly the Enlightenment was not a monolithic phenomenon, it was about disagreement and debate. The Enlightenment has its critics these days. Its belief in reason has been blamed for everything from the Holocaust to global warming. And naturally, it also has its defenders. One of these is the Franco-Bulgarian philosopher Svetan Todorov, who works at the Centre National de la Recherche Scientifique in Paris. He's the author of the recently published In Defence of the Enlightenment, and here he is at the Royal Society of Arts in London, defending the Enlightenment.
The Enlightenment was an era of debate, rather of consensus. It was an era of a balance between diverging ideas. Now, although the multiplicity of thought that I'm evoking to start with was considerable, I believe at the same time that we can recognize what can be described as the Enlightenment project. And I suggest that there are three major ideas, three is a good number in these occasions to have, to be found at the basis of the project, which produce countless consequences of their own. Autonomy is one. The human end purpose of our acts is another. And universality is a third one. The first constitutive characteristic of Enlightenment thinking, to me, consists in giving priority to what individuals decide for themselves over what is imposed on them by an external authority. This preference comprises two facets, one critical, the other constructive. It is necessary, on the one hand, to be free from external authorities, and on the other, to be guided by laws, norms, and rules decided by the very people to whom they are addressed. So emancipation and autonomy are the words that designate these two equally indispensable phases of a single process. To engage in it, one must have total freedom to examine, question, criticize, and challenge dogmas and institutions. An indirect but decisive consequence of this preference is the restriction as to the character of authority. It must be on the same dimension, on the same level as human beings, meaning it must be natural, not supernatural. Before the Enlightenment, human beings lived under an authority that was basically religious in nature. Its origin was therefore both anterior to society and it was also supernatural. Indeed, religion was the greatest target of Enlightenment criticism, the aim of which was to allow human beings to wrest control over their own destiny. However, this criticism was selectively directed. What was rejected was the submission of society and individuals to precepts whose sole legitimacy came from the fact that a tradition attributed them to gods or to ancestors. The lives of human beings were to be guided henceforth by a project for the future, not by an authority from the past. Nothing was said, on the other hand, about the religious experience per se, or about the idea of transcendence, or about any of the various moral doctrines propounded by particular religions. The criticism was aimed at the structure of society, not the content of beliefs. Religion was withdrawn from the realm of the state, not from the minds of individuals. The majority of Enlightenment thinkers identified not so much with atheism as with natural religion or deism or one of the many variations thereof. When they undertook to observe and describe the beliefs of people around the world, which they did so with the intent not of challenging religion and describe it as opium for the people or whatever, as an illusion, but of fostering an attitude of tolerance and defending freedom of conscience. Having cast off the shackles of the past, people set out to formulate new laws and norms using purely human means, without recourse this time to magic or revelation. The certainty of a unique source of light that religion used to describe, descended from above, gave way to the idea of a plurality of light sources spreading from one person to another. The first autonomy that needed to be acquired was the autonomy of knowledge. Hence the principle that no authority, no matter how well established and prestigious, is immune to criticism. That's why when people sought support from a prominent figure, they looked to scientists, not to philosophers. And so it was that Newton came to play a role in the Age of Enlightenment comparable to Darwin's in the subsequent centuries. The principle of autonomy caused an upheaval in the life of the individual and that of societies. The fight for the freedom of conscience that allows each person to choose his or her religion wasn't new at that time, but it had to be perpetually renewed, and it was extended by the demand for freedom of opinion, expression, and publication. Accepting human beings as the source of their own laws means accepting them totally as they are and not as they ought to be. And the fact is that human beings are both body and mind, passions and reason, sensuality and meditation. It suffices to observe real people instead of holding on an abstract, idealized image of them to see how infinitely diverse they are. This you can do by going from one country to another, but also simply by looking from one individual to another. The idea was evidenced most tellingly not by scholarly texts, but by the new literary genres that put the individual at the center of attention, the novel on the one hand, autobiography on the other. These genres no longer aspire to reveal eternal laws of human conduct or the exemplary character of each gesture. They strove instead to show singular men and women in particular situations. This idea was also expressed in paintings that turned away from the great mythological and religious subjects to show the ordinary gestures of unexceptional human beings depicted in everyday common activities. Example, Hogarth in England. The impact of ideas on action took sometimes the form of an advice addressed to benevolent rulers in the hope that the latter will alter their policies in consequence. But beyond the trend toward enlightened despotism or absolutism, as it was called, which cultivated autonomy of reason in rulers but maintained the subjection of the people to this rule, the demand for autonomy led to two principles. The first was that of the sovereignty. The origin of political power had to be found in the people, and nothing was superior to what was called now the general will. The second complementary principle was the one of individual freedom vis-a-vis state power, legitimate or illegitimate, within the bounds of an individual sphere of action. This freedom requires pluralism and a balance of powers. This demand for autonomy transformed the political society even more deeply by broadening and consummating the separation between the temporal and the spiritual. There was a tendency of that kind for all sectors of society to become secular, even though people as individuals held on to their faith. This development was not only confined to political power. It concerned, for instance, the legal system as well. From then on, only offenses, that is, misdeeds against society, were punishable, and they were to be distinguished from sins, moral wrongdoing with respect to a tradition. It concerned education, destined to be taken out of the hands of ecclesiastical authorities as schools became places where enlightened ideas were taught. It concerned the press, where public debate had its place. And it concerned the economy, where arbitrary constraints had to be removed and the free circulation of goods permitted, and whose basis had to be the value of work and individual effort rather than the privileges and hierarchies of the past. The most suitable place for all these changes to take place was the big city, where individual freedom was fostered and people had the chance to meet and discuss issues. Now, once the will of the individual and the will of the community had been released from the oversight of earlier authorities, were they meant to be entirely free and without limits? The answer is no. The spirit of the Enlightenment cannot be reduced to this demand for autonomy alone, for it brought with it its own means of regulation. The first concerns the end purposes of freed human deeds, which was in its turn brought down to earth and focused on human beings rather than on God.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Philosopher's Zone, and this is the philosopher Svetan Todorov talking in defense of the Enlightenment.
Whatever was waiting for us in the hereafter, human beings had to impart meaning to their earthly lives. The quest for salvation was replaced by the search for happiness. The state itself was there not to serve a divine plan, but to assume responsibility for the welfare of its citizens. The second restriction to the freedom of action of individuals and communities consisted in asserting that all human beings, by their very nature, have inalienable rights. In addition to the rights that citizens enjoy within their society, they have others that are common to all human beings on earth, and although these rights may not be written down, they are no less imperious. Every human being has the right to life, and hence the death penalty is illegitimate, even when it is applied to a criminal who has killed someone. If private murder is a crime, how can public murder not be? Every human being has the right to physical integrity, and hence torture is illegitimate, even when it is practiced for reasons of state. Belonging to the human race, to universal humanity, is more fundamental than belonging to a specific society. If all human beings had a set of identical rights, it followed that they were equal before the law. The demand for equality followed from the principle of universality, and it opened the way to struggles for rights that continue to this day. Women must be men's equals before the law. Slavery must be abolished, since depriving a human being of freedom can never be legitimate. Poor people, people with no position, and people on the margins of society must be recognized as having dignity too, and children are to be treated as individuals. This affirmation of human universality aroused curiosity about foreign societies. Travelers and scholars did not from one day to the next stop judging people in distant cultures on the basis of criteria derived from their own cultures, but their interest had been aroused. They became aware of the manifold forms that civilization can assume and began to accumulate information and analysis that were to change the idea of humanity over time. The same reasoning was applied to temporal plurality. The past ceased to be regarded as the embodiment of an everlasting ideal or as a mere repertory of examples, and came to be seen as a succession of historical periods, each with its own coherence and values. Knowledge of societies different from one's own enabled observers to direct a less naive gaze at themselves. In this way, Montesquieu, the French writer of 18th century, could criticize the Persians, but also imagine the Persians judiciously criticizing the French in the famous Persian letters. These are the broad outlines of the program that was formulated in the Age of Enlightenment. Now, let me step slightly aside and ask another question, which is, how are we to judge it today, 250 years after its appearance? On the one hand, in Europe and everywhere in the world where the Enlightenment had an impact, it unquestionably came out victorious against the adversary it was fighting. Our knowledge of the world has progressed freely without ideological prohibitions causing too much concern. Individuals don't fear the authority of tradition as much anymore and try to manage their private space by themselves, enjoying all the while great freedom of expression. Democracy, where popular sovereignty is exercised with respect to individual liberties, has become a model that is cherished or desired everywhere. Universal human rights are considered a common ideal, and equality before the law is the rule in any legitimate state. Pursuing personal happiness or common welfare are personal life choices that don't shock anyone anymore. However, on the other hand, the anticipated benefits have not always been achieved, and the promises formulated were not always kept. The 20th century in particular, which saw the bloodbath of two world wars, totalitarian regimes established in Europe and elsewhere, and the deadly consequences of technological inventions, seem to have definitively proven false all the hopes that had been formulated in the past, to the point that many people stopped claiming the Enlightenment as a reference, and the ideas conveyed by such terms as humanism, emancipation, progress, reason, and free will fell into disrepute. The unrelieved distance between what could be seen as a promise and today's realities compels us to draw an initial conclusion. Any strictly optimistic reading of history is illusory. And the fact is that faith in the linear, boundless progress of the human race tempted a number of Enlightenment thinkers. Turgot, Condorcet and others, believed that no matter how slow and discontinuous such progress might be, that humankind would eventually reach adulthood through the spread of culture and knowledge. This view of history as the accomplishment of a plan of providence, in a way, was picked up and reinforced by Hegel and later by Marx, through whom it became part and parcel of the communist doctrine. It would be mistaken, however, to attribute this belief to the spirit of the Enlightenment itself. The most important French language thinker of the Age of Enlightenment, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, stood in frontal opposition to this conception. He thought that the distinctive characteristic of the human species was not so much its march towards progress as its perfectibility, meaning its capacity to improve itself and the world. But the effects of this capacity were neither guaranteed nor irreversible. This attribute justified all efforts, but didn't ensure success. In addition, Rousseau believed that all progress was inevitably paid for by regression in another area. Fortuitous causes, he writes, have perfected human reason while deteriorating the species, made a being wicked while making him sociable. Rousseau didn't claim that deterioration was the only direction in which humankind was headed, nor did he recommend, as some would have it, a return to the past. He was, on the contrary, calling attention to the solidarity between positive and negative effects. The reason for this dual movement resides in the human condition itself. Human beings are endowed with the freedom that allows them to change themselves and the world, and it is this freedom that drives them to accomplish good and evil. Rousseau concludes, "Good and evil flow from the same source." The spirit of enlightenment uploaded the knowledge that releases human beings from oppressive external authorities. But it didn't consist in saying that, everything being determined and knowable, people would eventually learn how to wholly control the world and shape it according to their desires. The complexity of the matter is such that even the most ambitious scientific hypothesis must always be formulated with a certain amount of humility. Most effects come about by such singular ways and depend on causes so imperceptible and remote that they defy prediction. This is even truer when it comes to the study of society, precisely because the freedom of human beings to oppose their own nature and hence to act in unpredictable ways. When we look today to Enlightenment thinking for support in dealing with our current difficulties, we certainly cannot adopt unaltered the propositions formulated in the 18th century, not only because the world has changed, but also because the thinking was multiple, not one. Instead, what we need today is to re-establish Enlightenment thinking of the 21st century in a way that preserves the past heritage while subjecting it to a critical examination. In doing so, there is no risk that we will betray the Enlightenment. Just the opposite. It is through criticism that we remain faithful and put its teaching into practice. Thank you.
Details of Tsvetan Todorov's book In Defense of the Enlightenment on our website, abc.net.au/rn/philosopherszone. And our website is also where you need to go if you want to engage in philosophical conversation with us and your fellow listeners. Just head to this week's program and click on the spot that says Add Your Comment. I'm Alan Saunders. Thanks to producer Kyla Slavin and sound engineer Charlie McCune. Back next week.